Do you agree, Karen, that it's the exception that swallows the rule, that everybody tries to rely upon the reasonable relief and belief and informed consent? Would you say that's a correct statement?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's right. So, and again, it just gets back to my comments from earlier on, maybe you can and maybe you can get the consent. And by the way, the rule doesn't really say, it doesn't say anything about getting consent in writing, but my strong recommendation is that you do that. The intermediary rule does reference, and that's rule 107 that we're not really talking about because I think it's subsumed in this discussion. That rule does reference getting consent in writing, but my strong recommendation is to get the consent in writing and and the waiver. And I think the reasonable belief part of this is, I think, where it gets tricky. We're all under pressure to bring in business and to get the client signed up and get it done. We want to have our origination bottom line look great at the firm, and we want to get the business. We want to represent everybody. And that's all well and good, and we should have and strive for those financial goals. But you have to kind of take a step back, again, on this whether I should take this on. And that's why I think it's a great idea that if you have any doubts, if there's any little tiny voice inside of you that says, maybe there's a problem here, or maybe I should go ask someone else about this, go talk to someone. If your firm has a designated risk attorney or general counsel, go talk to them and just bounce ideas around on how to handle setting up any particular engagement that's going to involve these issues. It's better just flush it out now, and it's really a mistake, in my opinion, to put your head in the sand and say it's all going to be fine, and, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's not a problem. And I think that's right. 9 times out of 10, it's not a problem, but it's just that 10th time where this crops up and you just ignore that little feeling in the back of your mind that maybe there might be an issue. So act on it and flesh out these issues. Flesh it out with your clients. I mean, I think that the informed consent and full disclosure, it's not about just slipping a waiver letter to your clients and say, oh, here you go, just sign this, you know, it's no problem. You need to have an actual discussion with your joint clients on the pros and cons of the joint representation, and then put it in the letter and document it. Some lawyers will have risk lawyers will have a philosophy of putting all of the, you know, make the letter as big and bad and nasty as you possibly can, put everything in there. So later on, when they say you didn't tell me about that, it's in the letter. But I get it. You don't want to scare people away from hiring you. You want to get it documented and in a reasonable manner. But you've got to have you've got to sift through what you need to say in the letter, what you need to have the discussion with your clients on, again, the pros and cons in order to make the waiver really effective. So I think that the two go hand in hand, and I really think that getting some outside perspective is always a good idea.
ABA requires written informed consents, incidentally. And we'll talk about informed consents at the end if we have time. All right. So the informed consent, of course, is after full disclosure and then a lot of words talking about the pros and cons. And the form, informed consent at the back of the paper, gives some examples. So in short, Texas Rule 106C, the exception, allows lawyers to represent multiple parties if the lawyer has a reasonable belief and that the representation will be materially unaffected by multiple representation and the client gives informed consent. That's the key for the exception. All right, so let's take some examples and see if we can flesh this out by example. So we have a purchase and sale transaction, a seller, a buyer, and a lender, straightforward. And then the lender's attorney is going to be preparing the loan documents for the loan to the buyer. And as a courtesy, the lender's attorney prepares the deed for the seller because they're all friends and they all know each other, and the seller doesn't want to go hire their own lawyer because it costs too much money to hire a lawyer to prepare a deed, you know. That really is expensive. So the lender attorney does the loan documents and then does the deed for the seller. The source of this was a Texas Essex opinion in 1998, and the opinion held that the preparing the deed for the seller was not authorized without consent. I think the facts of the opinion were it was without consent. They just voluntarily prepared it and sent it to the seller. But the opinion went back to the exception in 106C, which we just discussed. You need consent plus the lawyer's reasonable belief. So as simple as that is of a transaction, it illustrates where there might be a tripwire. I don't really think that's so simple. I don't know that there's much more to be said about it. Karen, do you particularly?
No, only that it's just interesting that, you know, the lender's attorney may not have even realized that he or she was stepping into, what is ostensibly a lawyer-client relationship by preparing this deed.